Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. Pleasure to welcome everybody on behalf of Torah Motion, part three of our four-part series with Dr. Wirtz, The Changing Nature of Time and Halakha. How Shabbos used to start at different times. You tell people that what we discussed last week, it's a little mind-blowing for certain people, but that's the nature of Halakha, the nature of time. Time is relative. We haven't gotten to that yet, but it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Gewirtz to continue, I think, our discussion on the Chatam Sofer and the Satmar Rebbe and et cetera, et cetera. B'vakasha.
Thank you. Let me just start by just quickly reviewing what we talked about last time. We today basically start Shabbos at sunset, and most of us who are not following with the Rabbeinu Tam tend to end Shabbos 50 minutes, give or take some number of minutes after Shabbos, some as low as 40, some as high as 55. And those who are following, quote unquote, the Rabbeinu Tam, they wait 72 minutes. There are individuals we mentioned last time, like Rav Soloveitchik, who for diuresis waits 2.5 hours in the summer. But, you know, that those sorts of occurrences are rare. They're far between. On the other hand, in ancient times, let's stick specifically to the 18th and 17th century, it was common practice for those claiming to be following the Rabbeinu Tam to end Shabbos around the time that we do today. They didn't wait 72 minutes, going back to, you know, Rav Avraham Pimaltiel, and I would argue probably 150 years before that, though we can't prove that conclusively, people ended Shabbos relatively early. And what's more surprising is they didn't start Shabbos at sunset. They started Shabbos some good number of minutes before the time they ended it. Not hard to believe that they would start Shabbos around a half hour after sunset, and they would end Shabbos 50 some odd minutes after sunset. Some a little bit earlier, some a little bit later, but that was the point of view. And that makes the tshuva that the Chasam Sofer wrote extremely meaningful. He was asked about a baby born 27 minutes after sunset, 25 minutes before their practice end of Shabbos, 8:30, sunset at 8:03, Shabbos over 8:55, and he paskened the baby could have a bris on Shabbos. That would not happen today, I don't think, anywhere. Perhaps in some hidden Satmar community, you know, hiding out, I don't know where. Maybe Leif Tahar. I don't want to become funny about it. It's a really, really very, very unlikely occurrence, almost anywhere. Okay, that was his pshat. So that's what we did last time, and we went into some detail. Now we come to his quote from his Rebbe. He was a Talmud of Reb Nosson Adler, who we talked about last time. Reb Nosson Adler was certainly not a run-of-the-mill Gadol b'Yisrael. He had strange minhagim. He davened Nusach Sfard. He duchened every day. He did a variety of things that in Frankfurt, which you could imagine was a city that was like you would assume it to be, they had very strict minhagim, and occasionally they found him a little hard to take. And eventually he left. However, he was the Rebbe of the Chasam Sofer, in addition to other Rabbanim, Rabbi Shaya Horowitz, other people in Frankfurt were also part of his training, but his major Rebbe was Reb Nosson Adler. And he quoted at the end of his first volume of Chidushei Torah on Shas, on Seder Moed, he quotes his Rebbe, and he says that Bein HaShmashos is either 24 or 35 minutes. And you do whichever creates a chumrah if you're trying to be, if it involves a dioraisa, and you do whatever creates a kula if what you're trying to do is only a drabana. This sentence, this line, two lines, were whited out. It was apparent to all that the editor literally took an old-fashioned whiteout, whited out those lines, and published the Chasam Sofer. Undoubtedly, because they thought, I would imagine, that the Chasam Sofer's Rebbe, and again, he's not, you know, he doesn't quote that many things from his Rebbe, but he's quoting this. So you would assume that he probably agrees with it and thinks it's very important. And he says 24 or 35 minutes, whichever is a chumrah you take, you know, for the Urias and whatever. Tamer thought that meant that Shabbos is over 24 or 35 minutes after sunset, which, you know, having, you know, just agreed that no one in America would wait less than 42 minutes, this was a travesty beyond belief. What's also the case is that it's impossible that Rav Nosson Adler, who was normally, I wouldn't call him, you know, absolute machmir, but he was not a lenient person. So for him to have said something like that is completely out of the question. What's more, the baby that was born 27 minutes, that 27 is 8 minutes less than 35, the Chasam Sofer would never have gone against his Rebbe and said a bris for a baby born 27 minutes after sunset can occur on Shabbos. His Rebbe said, if the Samar interpretation were theoretically and ridiculously correct, the Chasam Sofer would have to listen to that. He would never, never, in an Isser D'Oraisa, have disobeyed his Rebbe. Okay, so it's clear that they edited and they didn't really understand what the text was implying. That's okay, fine. Let's assume that for the moment. I think that that's provable. Question now is, what did Rav Nosson Adler mean? What was this? What was he trying to tell us? Clearly something important, because it was recorded. You don't have a lot of Rav Nosson Adler recorded almost anywhere. So let's first start with a question. And this is a very, very, very important and fundamental question. Was he counting forward or was he counting back? Now, what I mean by that, if you learn the Gemara in Shabbos, the most important sugya, if you want to understand Zimanim with respect to Bein HaShmashos, is the sugya in Shabbos, starting on Daf Lamed Dalet, Amud Aleph, going through Daf Lamed Hey, and that's the sugya to learn. Now, the sugya is subject to many, many, many interpretations. Recently, I wrote a paper that one particular line has 28 different ways that Rishonim and Achronim dealt with it, and trying to figure out of those which is most likely. Okay, learn the sugya without, you know, just read it without anyone, and ask yourself one question: what is the sugya trying to figure out? And you have to come to one conclusion, a conclusion that I will tell you not everyone comes to. But the conclusion that I would come to, and I think a reader would come to if they aren't informed by a lot of what was written about the sugya, certainly an academic reader would tell you that the sugya knows when Shabbos ends. When Shabbos is over is not a question. The sugya, given where it's placed in the second perek, is trying to figure out when Shabbos starts on Friday night. It knows when it's over Saturday night. At the end of Shabbos, the Gemara has a number of statements. None of them are disputed, at least until recently. There are many kashas that first came up in the 20th century, which tells you that the interpretation that held sway for well over 1,500 years probably was of the opinion that the Gemara knew when Shabbos ends. Two definitions are given in the Gemara. One is the appearance of three stars, which I think all of us are familiar with. And the other is a much more technical expression, which the northernmost point of the sky appears as dark as the eastern horizon. Now, I will tell you that that definition is probably the fundamental definition. And I believe Charles Lieberman said that stars don't appear in the early halachic literature. The only definition that appears are various ways of defining darkness. This one, that the darkness at the top of the sky equals the darkness in the eastern horizon. Okay, that's probably the most fundamental. But that's not important. What is important, regardless of whether you believe stars are defining or darkness is defining, Shabbos night is a given. We don't care about Shabbos night. We know when Shabbos night. What we're trying to figure out is when Shabbos starts. So one possibility is that Rav Nosson Adler was following modern parlance, which I believe the Satmar were influenced by. They too are influenced by the way we talk. We today, 100% of the time, talk in terms of sunset. Shabbos is over 52 minutes after sunset, light candles 18 minutes before sunset, 40 minutes in Yerushalayim. Everybody today talks in terms of sunset. Don't assume that that's the way Rav Nosson Adler was speaking, because he lived, you know, 200 years, over 200 years ago. And perhaps he was counting back. So now we have to basically figure out, was he counting forward or was he counting back? Now, counting forward from sunset, that's impossible. Way too liberal. Okay, maybe he was counting forward from some other time. Well, if that time was less than 27 minutes, again, the Chasam Sofer runs into a problem. His Rebbe started Bein HaShemashos already. No bris. No bris after Bein HaShemashos. So maybe he was counting forward from some time which we don't know. That's more than 27 minutes. That is a possibility. You can't rule that out. However, if that's what he was doing, his statement is entirely not telling you what that point was. He's not telling you anything. His statement is effectively, you know, it's a vacuous statement. Count forward 24 minutes or 35 minutes from a time I didn't tell you. Sunset, we all know about. The time he didn't identify, Iker Chaser Min HaSefer. So he must be counting back. And that, I think, makes a lot of sense. You'll find other contemporaries of him who wrote Svarim, who counted back. Particularly the Nesivos, Rabbi Yaakov Loberbaum. So where was he counting back from? Here there are two possibilities. He was counting back from the practiced end of Shabbos at his time in Central Europe, which would mean he's counting back from somewhere about, let's be very, very machmir, and say 55 minutes after sunset. So he's counting back from 55 minutes after sunset. That is a chumrah of a couple of minutes compared to what was practiced in most European, Central European cities, certainly in Germany and Austria and Hungary. Poland was always a different story. We're not talking about Poland. He wasn't a rav in Poland. So if you assume 55 minutes, take back 35, that would say that, you know, 20 minutes after sunset, 55 minus 35, you have to be choshesh for a d'oraisa. Well, providing a bris is a d'oraisa. So that possibility gets washed away. Even as 24 minutes is 31 minutes, you know, is a minute after the baby was born. That would also not be such a good thing. But anyway, so that's probably not what he meant. What he probably meant, and this is conjecture, but it's the best I can do, is Rav Nosson Adler was, unlike other people, waited a full 72 minutes. So he had, in his mind, 72 minutes is when Shabbos is over. So he said to himself as follows. 35 minutes before 72 is 37 minutes after sunset, which is, you know, is very consistent with what the Chassam Sofer said and did. It also happens to be the precise time that the Nesivos, Rabbi Yaakov Oberbaum, wrote is the absolute latest time to do Isurei D'oraisa. You cannot do an Isur D'oraisa more than 37 minutes after. He actually said 37 and a half, to be perfectly honest. So they are differing by half a minute. Rav Nelson Adler probably is not calculating to half minutes. He says 37. That makes tremendous amount of sense, that his 35 minutes counted back from his end of Shabbos corresponds exactly to the position of one of the other major, major gedolim of Central Europe at that time, Rabbi Yaakov Oberbaum. What's 24? Well, if you count back 24 from 72, you get the 48 minutes after, which is a few minutes before people would end Shabbos. So what he was saying, if you have a real need to be over an Isur Derabbanan, don't go up to the time, obviously, at which Shabbos has ended, but go a couple of minutes earlier. And that's his 24-minute psak. And that seems to correspond. Now, why a few minutes earlier? Perhaps he's trying to get rid of Tosefet Shabbos. In other words, Tosefet Shabbos should not be an issue with respect to allowing you to do work during Tosefet Shabbos. He could have had any number of reasons to be machmir a little bit more than the practiced end of Shabbos. But him corresponding closely with 24 and 35 to the latest beginning and 5 or 6 minutes before the practiced end seems to me to be a reasonable guess as to what he was saying. And it will be something that everybody would know, because everybody was aware of 72 minutes, despite the fact that nobody practiced 72 minutes. Many people asked questions, why aren't we practicing 72 minutes? And the answer was, we see stars. And, you know, 72 minutes is, you know, stars are what people use, not a clock. And so anyway, that's my conjecture as to what Chassam Sofer, what the Chassam Sofer quoted from his Rebbe. And if that's the case, you know, Satmar had absolutely no reason to censor it. It was, you know, they may have wanted to, you know, it's a guy who waits 72 minutes, like them, who says for the rest of us who are not, waiting 72 minutes, that the halacha is 35 and 24, 35 for the Oraisas and 24 for the Rabbanans. And that's the likely explanation of what Rav Nelson Adler meant. So that ends, you know, and believe me, after the period of the Chassam Sofer, from 1850 on, life began to diverge. You see machlokas, because the shita of the Vilner Gaon and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, first Lubavitcher Rebbe to a, I would say a lesser extent, but also to a very influential extent. Lubavitcher was, you know, an extremely influential Hasidic group, you know, different than they are today, but that's a story for a different day. Their influence was very, very strong in many Hasidic circles, as well as in Misnagdish circles. Okay. And as their view began to be known, so people started starting Shabbos earlier, and the disregard for the Rabbeinu Tam, except in various yeshiva circles and in Hasidic circles, became absolute. I may have mentioned last time, among the people who did not wait as long as Rabbeinu Tam was the Chazon Ish. So if you can imagine the Chazon Ish abandoning the Rabbeinu Tam, you have to understand that he wasn't the only yeshivish trained gadol who did that. It became pretty much well understood in many areas. Brisk is different, as you could imagine. Brisker took on chumras, you know, unknown to people before. In fact, you know, things were actually named, if you know the time, the Brisker Achtel and the Brisker Zechtel, not knowing that these shitos go back to Rabbeinu Tam and Ramban because they had been totally disregarded in Northern European circles, given the guy in the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So when the Brisker started them again, they got named after them. So you could understand how strong the opinion of the Gaon, which started Shabbos as we do, and ended Shabbos around the time that we did. In fact, I will not for tonight at all, we are more machmir than most of the rabbis at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. How that happened, story for a different day. Okay, end of this, on to the next. This story about the dateline, today what I'm going to cover is I'm going to give you the classical interpretations and some of the history. But before I start, I want to give you a little personal history. About, I think, 12 years ago, I think it was 2010, I was in Yerushalayim, ostensibly on vacation, but I got wrangled into helping Mosada Rav Kook and Tchumim with various issues they were having in terms of using modern technology to speed up the, you know, the production of the Encyclopedia Talmudis. Tchumim was in much better shape. But anyway, as a result of that, I met a wonderful individual by the name of Rav Uri Dasberg, who Nebuch had a massive heart attack and drove off, you know, driving near Gush, and killed, and I think others were in his car as well. He and I got very friendly. We talked about a lot of stuff. And he invites me to a shiur given at Encyclopedia Talmudis by Rav Tzvi Karen. Rav Tzvi Karen, unlike many of the Rosh Yeshiva, many of whom have been nifter, Rav Zalman Nechemia Gover, Zecha Tzadik Livracha, one of the children of Rav Shuchotovich, they spoke more rabbinic Hebrew that I was very comfortable with. Rav Tzvi Karen, who I believe wrote a sefer on the Beis Hamikdash, and he's somewhere between an academic and a traditional, you know, Talmud scholar, he gave a shiur on discovered letters between the Chazon Ish and Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Now, I cannot promise, and I certainly, you know, admit that I may have not heard him perfectly. I would turn occasionally to Uri Dasberg to translate something that I was totally unaware of what he had just said. But I did catch the conversation between him and Rav Shuchotovich's sons and Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, and the letters were remarkable. There is a number of people who are not happy that these letters have seen the light of day. I have not seen them, and I don't know how to get my hands on them. But I haven't tried. I'm going to Israel next month with the express purpose of trying to find somebody at Mossad Rav Kook or Encyclopedia Talmudis who can get these letters. There are a lot of such things, by the way. I did get my hands on the correspondence between Rav Herzog and a professor at the Hebrew University, 80 pages worth of back and forth on this topic. That was good. You can actually read it. But nonetheless, what Rav Isser Zalman told the Chazon Ish, as best as I heard it, was why are we referring to himself and the Chazon Ish as two Rosh Yeshiva? Why are we arguing about something that has already been decided in Pesach? And he says to him, your Shita was the Shita of Rav Moshe Lapidus. Rav Moshe Lapidus was the Rav in Reisen. Some of you who know the history of the Soloveitchik family, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, was appointed by his father, or his father influenced the people of Ryzen to appoint the Rav's father as the Rav of Ryzen after Rav Moshe Lapidus. And Rav Moshe Lapidus had the same shita as the Chazon Ish, but, you know, squared. He was more radical about it. And by the way, the Brisker adopted some of that radicalism, which led to other issues, which we won't talk about. However, when Rav Moshe Lapidus paskened that, Rav Shaul Natanson, you know, Rav Shaul Natanson was a Shaul Meshiv. He was one of the greatest poskim of the time. Kind of, you know, on par with, you know, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan and Rav David Karliner. These were like, you know, these were not Rashi Yeshiva of the Litvisha type. These were honest to goodness, you know, seeped in halacha poskim. Think Rav Moshe Feinstein or Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, though by that time, things had gotten a little, you know, merged between the two. And he says to him, Rav Shaul Natanson already said Rav Moshe Lapidus is wrong. End of story. And he gave an argument why, which we'll get to. And he says, why are we mishing into this? Why don't we just take the psak of Rav Shaul Natanson and go home? Why are we arguing about this? And that was a very, now, interesting, I believe, I know one of the sons of Rav Shmulevitz jumps out of his chair. He's like, he was agitated and says, why would the Chazon Ish care about Rav Shaul Natanson if he didn't care about the Chasam Sofer? He said he would argue on the Chasam Sofer whenever, you know, whenever he thought he was wrong. He was more than happy to argue on the Chasam Sofer. You know, the Chasam Sofer, you know, compared, at which point, Zalman Nechemiah Gol also, Becher Tzadik Levacha, gets up, and in the most polite way possible, I can't imitate his politeness. He basically says, you don't understand the Litvish mentality, which is not quite the right thing to say to children, to a Rosh Hashiva. But he says, the Chasam Sofer was a Rosh Hashiva like the rest of us. Shaul Natanson was a Pesach. And believe me, in Litta, they knew the difference. And when the Pesach paskin, you didn't ask questions. Famous story about, you know, about Reb Chaim telling the Yitzchak Elchanan to send them a psak and don't send me any reasons. You send me the reasons, I'll doubt it. What people don't know is the Rav's grandfather, same name, Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, left Brisk for a couple of years to learn with Rav Shlomo Klugger because he wanted to be a Shtotzrav. And to be a Shtotzrav, you have to paskin. So there was no one for him to learn psak from. He went to the greatest posek of the time, Rav Shlomo Klugger. Okay, so that was the conversation I heard. That conversation got into a lot of things about the position of Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer. I cannot tell you that what I'm going to get into next week is a fair representation of what I heard. I will tell you it's not. It's a little bit more philosophical. It's a little bit more strongly argued, but it is similar to the point of view of Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer and Rav Tzvi Pesa Frank, and it expresses it in a slightly more logical, you know, and I mean logic in the strict sense, it's, you know, I have a PhD in mathematical, it's a more logical way of expressing their point of view. It's a little bit more formal, but we'll get to that next week. What I want to do now is I want to, you know, tell you a little bit about how we got here. What the history, you know, the dateline was a Shiloh. It first came up, the first place that something like a dateline exists in written literature, as far as I know, and I've checked non-Jewish sources, and as none of them make reference to anything prior to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari. So the first place there is a mention of a dateline is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Almost, 50, 60 years later, we have the more famous Rav Zerachya Halevi, the Baal Hamor, which everyone quotes as one of the original proponents of a particular dateline, as well in both Syria and in the environs of southern France, Barcelona, that bottom part of the European continent, there is already secular texts that talk about the dateline. I'm going to talk specifically, I'm not going to try to pronounce his name, Nicholas or something, or Simi or something. My French is, those of you from Canada may know how to pronounce O-R-S-E-M-E. But anyway, he wrote a textbook, and he wrote a very, very detailed textbook that I would guess that the notion of a dateline, the Baal Hamor, who was not at all unfamiliar with the secular world around him. In fact, he was very familiar with what was going around in the secular world. Whether he influenced the Baal Hamor or the Baal Hamor influenced him, I don't know. They were close enough in time to each other, because it took a long time for books to get written, and his book was well distributed. The Baal Hamor said the following. We'll start with the Baal Hamor. The Baal Hamor said, the earth is round. Well, that already, to anyone, knowledge that the earth is round can be shown from two places purportedly in all of Talmudic literature. There's the Yerushalmi that refers to a kadur. Now, whether that means a disc or a round ball that we think of, not clear. My suspicion is a disc, not a ball. The other place is the Zohar, which to most moderns is proof that the Zohar was not written before the 13th century, when people first discovered a round earth. So, in other words, the Zohar is quoting the Zohar as ancient proof of a round earth, will either get you belief in certain circles, or someone will say, you've added another proof to my belief that the Zohar, with all of its Spanish Aramaic, was not written in Talmudic times. But nonetheless, the major sugya in Shas about the human geography is in Psachim and Daf Tzadi Dalet Amid Aleph. It's also an extremely important sugya for Zmanim. Again, a sugya where line by line, there's a lot to argue about. The text has not remained constant over the years. So you have to do some significant study to figure out who was reading what when they were reading Daf Tzadi Dalet Amid Aleph. But nonetheless, it is clear, no matter what text you read of Daf Tzadi Dalet Amid Aleph, that the world is flat. Is it a square? Is it a disc? Is it, a circle, a circular figure? That you can read the Gemara, but there is not a hint in the Gemara which records a machlokas between non-Jewish astronomers and the Jewish astronomers, where the Gemara seems to conclude, I would say concludes, that the non-Jewish view seems to be correct. But it's an important sugi that I bring up here simply because it clearly talks about a flat earth. Comes along the Baal Hamor. He now is convinced that the earth is round. And now he goes to the Gemara, which we talked about, that I told you we'd get back to, the Gemara that says that if the Molad is after 12 o'clock in the afternoon, then that day is not declared Rosh Chodesh. Okay, 12 o'clock. That means they're counting 6 to 6. When it comes to Rosh Chodesh, the clock is a 6 to 6 clock, adjusted as it has to for other reasons. Well, 12 o'clock is really 12 o'clock. It's at 18 hours into a particular day. So if the molad is in the last 6 hours, we don't declare that day Rosh Chodesh. Comes the Baal Mor with one of the most brilliant arguments. The Baal Mor, I don't know if you know his reputation. He was brilliant. With a capital B, argued on everybody, had views that Yechidei Segula, he had no one, the Ravid was opposed, the Ramban was opposed. Everybody argues on the Baal Mor. I have never read anyone who defends the Baal Mor. But anyway, he had the following view. He says, at 12 o'clock, I know what's going on. He says, when it's 12 o'clock in Eretz Yisrael, 18 hours from there, take a minute before 12 o'clock and go 18 hours around the circle in the westerly direction, through Europe, through America, you didn't know from these places, across the Pacific, and you'll find yourself on the Asian continent. What time is it about to be? It's a minute before 6. So that place, 18 hours forward, will have a full day of Rosh Chodesh if Rosh Chodesh in Jerusalem was before 12 o'clock. And since one place on earth will have a full day, we can declare Rosh Chodesh on that day. Once 12 o'clock passes, no one anywhere on the surface of the earth will have a full day. As a result, he argues, Beis Din is not going to declare Rosh Chodesh. That's his argument. Now, we can go into a lot of detail about his argument. And I'm looking at the clock, and we certainly, unless we have 5 or 6, this would have to become Shaul Lieberman with Professor Shapiro. We have to go 18 lectures to discuss the lundus behind the Baal Mor. But there is one fundamental question, which I don't believe has a good resolution. What we mentioned last time was the molad referred to in that sugya is not the real molad. It's an average molad. Why would an average molad have this much importance? What was the reason that the Chazon Ish and the Baal Mor attached so much significance to something that was by itself known to be an act? I don't know. Nonetheless, the Shita of the Chazon Ish has spread like wildfire. There are Rosh Yeshiva, at YU, of Herschel Schachter, who is Choshesh for the Chazon Ish. Interestingly, among some Haredi Gedolei HaPoskim, they were not Choshesh for the Chazon Ish. The reasons we'll get to, because I think he was voted down in Yerushalayim. And most of the Haredi Rosh Yeshiva are probably in Israel. And in Israel, the Chazon Ish's psak on this particular matter probably had opposition. People have maligned the opposition pretty badly. There are a lot of stories in the Naked City, so to speak, about this controversy, most of which are urban legends trying to build up the position of the Chazon Ish, but that nonetheless, we'll get to those who argued with the Chazon Ish back then. But let's go back to the time of the Baal Mor. At the time of the Baal Mor, somebody said something that was, I would argue, extremely profound, and something that was not believed completely for a few hundred years. And I'll tell you how it was, quote unquote, absolutely verified. Take two mystical travelers, one by the name of Aristotle and one by the name of Plato. And they're both going to leave from the city. Let's have them leave from Provence. Nice place the Bellamore lived there. And Plato travels west. He travels from Provence through Spain, across the Atlantic. I don't know if he's on a boat or he's walking and building rafts. He somehow makes it all the way around the world, all the way back across Asia, across the Middle East, across, you know, Eastern Europe, all the way back to Provence. On the other hand, Aristotle is tasked to go the other way. So he leaves, covers Italy, Israel, the Middle East, India, China, by some miracle crosses the Pacific Ocean, crosses North America, crosses the Atlantic, and comes back to Provence. And the two come back on the same day. And the day they choose to come back is Wednesday. So Plato, who was traveling to the West, United States, Pacific, Asia back, says it's Tuesday. And Aristotle, who was traveling the other way, says, no, it's not. It's Thursday. Of course, the people in Barcelona who were there all the time and at the end of every 24 hours flipped over to the next day say it is Wednesday. Now, what's going on? Let me give you a modern equivalent, and I'm going to save you all the mathematics. The modern equivalent is equivalent to the story about Plato and Aristotle. A baby is born Tuesday in New York, let's make it Toronto. I'm sorry, we have to be more kind to the hosts. Baby is born in Toronto, and two planes take off from Toronto. They're twins, I'm sorry, twins. Maybe make them triplets. One baby stays in Toronto. So we know that he's born Tuesday. We know exactly 8 days later he's going to have a bris. The other baby gets on a plane and he starts flying to Vancouver across the Pacific at whatever latitude he's at, circumnavigates the world, and he has to go at the same speed as the sun. So if he's looking out the window, say he left at 12 o'clock, he will come back to Toronto if he's following the speed of the sun, which is not hard. The sun is going a little faster. It's not Concorde-like. It's just a little faster than a current plane, comes back 24 hours later, and the entire trip, looking out the window, he sees the sun. High noon. It's high noon the entire time. And those of you who've traveled west to San Francisco, you get there earlier. You travel to Tokyo. You arrive, it says the next day, but you didn't see the sunset. So this plane that's flying around the world at the speed of the sun, it turns out this will be true if you go at any speed less than or equal to the speed of the sun, which, of course, the theoretical travelers, Plato and Aristotle, were not on planes yet back then. He comes back and has seen no sunset. So he lands and he says, oh, what day did I leave? I left on Wednesday. Must be Wednesday. The guy flying the other way, all of you who know who've gone to Eretz Yisrael, as soon as he take off, 6 hours later, take off at 12 noon, it's 6 o'clock. Next day, go another 12 hours, you know, six daylight, six night. Well, next day again, another 6 hours, you're back in Toronto. How many sunsets have you seen? Two. So you say, oh, it's not Wednesday anymore. I'm sorry. The person, you know, I've seen two sunsets. It's not Thursday like the people in Toronto say. It's Friday. I've seen two sunsets. So Plato, who traveled west every day, the day got slightly longer. And those slightlies added up. And by the time he gets back totally around the earth, he finds out that the day he thinks is a day earlier, because every day his sunset was delayed a couple of minutes, maybe a half a minute, maybe a third of a minute. If it took him 3 years, whatever it took him, add all that up, it equals exactly one day. The guy going the other way, his days got shorter and shorter and shorter by the smallest of amounts. Add them all up, he had an extra day. So this paradox was promulgated in the 13th century, written about extensively, argued about extensively. And this drove people crazy. People didn't believe it. People had arguments. Truth is that the paradox is absolutely, absolutely correct. And what you have, the explanation is exactly what I just said. The guy going west saw an additional sunset. The guy going east, saw no sunset. If you go west, the guy going east saw two sunsets. So they're off. You know, one guy says it's a day earlier because he didn't see the sunset. The other guy says it's a day later because he saw the sunset. Comes 19. Those of you who know when Magellan circumnavigated the globe, Magellan went west, young man. He went under South America, across the Pacific. Unfortunately, by the way, he had 270 people on board, of which I think about 30 survived to make it back. He was killed when they landed in the Philippines, and I guess the natives weren't that happy to see him. There wasn't a very big Kabbalist upon him, but Magellan didn't make it past the Philippines. However, on the boat was somebody recording the days, recording astronomical events, recording whatever has to be recorded. And when he came back, having traveled west, he completely verified what Plato had told him. He said, oh my God, I have seen one less day than you who are staying here, wherever he took off from. So we therefore learned that the paradox that effectively necessitated a dateline is not made up. It's real. If people are traveling one direction, they're going to experience an extra day, and they're going to be different than people traveling in the other direction. So people said, this is a problem. This is a problem. Problems need solutions. So they came up with something called the International Dateline. And associated with the International Dateline, they promulgated a rule. If you are going and you cross the International Dateline, going in the westerly direction, like Magellan, it's the next day. A miracle. Now, one side of the dateline, Friday. Cross to the other side of the dateline, Shabbos. You know, cross back, Friday. Cross forward, Shabbos. However, if you're going the other direction, you're going from Japan to the United States, which, by the way, causes all sorts of shilas for people who do that on Friday. I do that, so, you know, we won't talk about that. If you go the other way and you cross the date line, it becomes Friday again. So if you leave Japan, it gets dark, which ostensibly makes it Shabbos. And then you cross the date line, you're back to Friday. Question is, you know, is that how we should paskin? Topic for a very different day. We're not talking about traveling Pesach. We're going to try to just get fixed Pesach under control, and we'll call it a day. Okay, so you go back to Friday. This solves the problem. Magellan pushed a day forward. Had they gone around Africa and come back the other way, they would cross the dateline, push a day back, and they wouldn't be 2 days ahead. They would correctly, everything would work out correctly. So that's the international community. Now, the international community, for a while, there were people proposing, you know, doing this outside the Pope's residence. So people eventually figured out it's not a good idea. Not a good idea to do it in Yerushalayim. Not a good idea to do it anywhere. Do it where there ain't no people. So where do they pick? The middle of the Pacific. And they have various, you know, at various times in the last 150 years, they made adjustments. It, you know, zigzagged a little here, zigzagged a little there. But we had an international dateline. And that was the way the dateline was set up. Comes the Chazon Ish and says, there's also a halachic dateline. Where that halachic dateline is exactly where I told you. It is 180 degrees from Yerushalayim going west, 90 degrees going in the other direction. Now, you could argue, even if you were to overcome all your skepticism, that the Baal HaMor was not talking about a line. He may have been talking about a point. He may, and it, you know, it's not clear at all everything that he made. But in addition, but the Chazon Ish had a real problem. If that's where the dateline is smack in the middle of China, smack in the middle of Australia. So you walk across the street, it's Shabbos. You walk back, it's Friday. You can be making Havdalah on one side of the street, and on the other side of the street, someone is about to be welcoming the Shabbos, singing l'chadodi. You know, so this is a very, so the Chazon Ish came up with the notion that everything drags in the direction of the major continent, or otherwise said, in, you know, with preference to Yerushalayim. So it doesn't end abruptly, it goes until the shore. It doesn't end in Australia abruptly. It goes until the shore. But Japan and New Zealand, they're no longer part of the continent. It's offshore. It's across a body of water. Those places are of Gokhtitsars. Those places have to keep. The dateline is between them and Australia. So New Zealand is already the next day. Japan the next day. So the Chazon, this is the famous psak of the Chazon Ish that tells people don't fast for Yom Kippur on Wednesday, but wait till Thursday, because that thing starts the day early. Now, there's a lot to be written and said about that psak of the Chazon Ish. The Brisker never, you know, they heard the psak of, you know, of 50 years before. So they assume that psak is you can walk across the street and you can walk in and out of Shabbos. How they dealt with that, I don't know. But that was during the Second World War. The Brisker Rav, Yitzchak Zev, tried to contact the Dayan of Brisk, Rabbi Rieger. And he wanted a psak. He wanted Rav Rieger to tell him, what did his father agree with the Chazon Ish, or did his father agree with the original psak of Rav Moshe Lapidus? Because of the war, he never was able to get a return telegram. And what he did is cloaked in mystery, to say the least. Though everybody claims they know. I don't think any historian has found a document to make that clear. The other major opinions was the greatest person in Zmanim of the 20th century was someone by the name of Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky. Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky was married to the granddaughter of Rav Shmuel Salant. Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky said that Yerushalayim is the top of the world, and the dateline is 180 degrees from Yerushalayim in both directions. And there are people to this day who are machmir. That, by the way, puts Hawaii on the wrong side of the dateline. So if you go to Hawaii, it snaps into North America in Alaska, but you could use the Chazon Ish's argument and treat Alaska as uniform if you'd like. We'll talk about that more next week. That was his psalm. The most innovative psalm, and with this we'll end, One of the people who got this shaila, again, argued about who got the shaila, but one of the people who we know got the shaila was the Gera Rebbe. The Gera Rebbe was living in Yerushalayim. He had escaped. He was in Yerushalayim. He got the shaila. There were many Gera Hasidim learning in the Mir in Shanghai, and they wanted to know what to do about Yom Kippur. The Gera Rebbe gave the shaila to Rav David Shapiro. Rav David Shapiro is probably one of the least known, and I would have to argue probably the most inventive gadol of the last century. He got smicha in, I'll remember the name of the, of someone who considered the Satmar too pro-Israel. It's a rav in pre-war Hungary. The name ran away. He then went to Eretz Yisrael. His first sefer, in which he wrote about the shaila, had haskamas all the way from Hasidim to Reb Chaim Ozer to Rav Kook. He became a student of Rav Kook and started to teach in Rav Kook's yeshiva. That probably made some of his old Hasidic friends not entirely happy. Nonetheless, he came up with a dateline based on a medrash. And his dateline first was 8 degrees from the international dateline. He then made a revision and placed it 2 degrees from the international dateline, which of course meant for all intents and purposes, you can use the international dateline. And again, he was accused of doing that based on a desire for that answer there are people who did that. But he did it based on a midrash, which basically told us that the earth at 9 o'clock in the morning in Yerushalayim, the sun and the moon were placed in the sky. So he considered 9 o'clock in Yerushalayim, which is 135 degrees, from Yerushalayim, going in the other direction to be the place of the dateline. With some other minor things, if you check it out, that's very close to the international dateline. Nobody, as best I can tell, is choshesh for the shita of Rav David Shapiro. He answered all sorts of impossible kashas in his sfarim. I'll end with a quote from Rabbi Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha: not everything that's brilliant is true. I think that Rav David Shapiro is probably a prime example of someone who was beyond brilliant. You really have to read many of his tshuvot, but they were, to say the least, a little bit, I don't know what the word is, they were a little different than what you saw from other poskim. He really was not so much into psak as he was into explaining halachot. But anyway, that's the background. Those are the other shitas. In opposition to all of that, you have Mr. Zalman Meltzer, and you have Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, as well as someone not in Europe, in Yerushalayim, the Vina Rav, who also opined in this direction. And they had a radically different approach, which I will explain when we start next week. And then we'll go slowly through the problem, almost painfully slow. And I will show you that from a very strict logical point of view, we don't need a dateline. And their approach and I believe they meant this, at least if I believe what I heard 11 or 12 years ago, but I don't think they expressed it or had, one of the advantages of modern mathematics is it gives you new tools to express things precisely. And I think the difference between what I'm going to tell you and what they were arguing is simply a function of they didn't have the tools necessary to describe things as accurately, but fundamentally it amounts to the same position. So now if there are any questions, I guess Rabbi Kelman can tell me.
Let's see here. I don't really see any questions.
Everyone is right. I can't pronounce.
Comments, a few comments.
Yeah.
Northernmost point is in the Polaris like star. I guess that's a question.
What is
you're
that?
Saying when Shabbos ends, you said there were two times the Gemara has for Shabbos ending, the three stars, and then when the stars, I think the northernmost star, I think that's what you said. I assume that's what that's in reference to.
Yeah, I don't know that. I know that is
you
not.
You can clarify if you want, but otherwise, okay.
Yeah, I will check that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
See you next week for the final part
the
of
the final,
series.
Yes. Yes. Next week is not going to be so Torah dick. It'll be a little bit more logic than Torah, but we'll have a fair amount of time.
That's okay. That's okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Tomorrow, 1:30. Rabbi Avram Kowalski from Yerushalayim will be continuing his fascinating series. Tomorrow we'll be discussing manna from heaven. Dr. Sokolo continues tomorrow night, of course, at 8:00. Thursday, Malka Simkowitz is starting her series at 10:30 a.m. on the Jews of Ancient Egypt, followed by Shuli Mishkin, of course, at 12. And then Rabbi Nadi Helfgott will be giving the Parsha Shir this Thursday evening from Tinek. And then my Shir on Friday morning on the Siddur. And then, Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday. And then next Monday night, Mark Shapiro will be resuming. We'll be back after a few week hiatus. And his new series will be on the rise of Reform Judaism. So you can sign up, and we look forward to learning with you. And we look forward to learning with your friends, who you'll hopefully invite to come and join us. Okay, everybody, Laila Tov, be well, and we hope to see you soon. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.